Hello, and welcome to Oxford Development Talks, a series of live and pre-recorded talks and interviews co-created by the Oxford Department of International Development and the Oxford Society for International Development. It is intended to showcase the best of Oxford International Development research for a wider public audience, particularly in a time where understanding global issues and the ways to respond is extremely important. My name is Mia Simovic, and I'm the co-president for Oxford in my second year studying geography. I'm delighted to be hosting the podcast today, and we are joined by Rob Talpaley, a Liberian author, activist, and academic who investigates race, South-South migration, citizenship, post-war recovery, and development cooperation in her research. Robtel works at the intersection of critical development studies and critical African studies and investigates how the so-called Global South is constructed and imagined by intellectual discourses in order to subvert and challenge them. She has conducted fieldwork in countries such as Ghana, Liberia, Sierra Leone, Somaliland, the UK and the US, to name a few. Today on the podcast, we'll be challenging the white gaze of development during the COVID-19 pandemic and taking a closer look at her most recent article in Al Jazeera English, titled Africa Does Not Need Saving During the Pandemic. Robtel, thank you so much for joining me today and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Mia. This is a pleasure to have a conversation with you.
Thank you. And Robtel, I'd like to start by asking you about your research into race and development. In your recent paper, titled Decentering the White Gaze of Development, you talk about how slavery, colonialism, and imperialism represent the historical antecedents of development, and about how globalization and neoliberalism represent its contemporary manifestations. But what do you think are the greatest reasons for how and why race remains, as you say, an absent presence in development? What are the issues with adopting a colorblind outlook? And do you think we are making any inroads in scholarship and policy into subverting the white gaze of development, as you term it?
Thank you for the question. So I'd like to start by providing some context for the paper that was published in Development and Change in October 2019. And I'm happy and pleased to share that the paper was one of the most widely read in 2018-2019. The publisher, Wiley, sent me the announcement, which made me very, very chuffed. So the paper is actually based on a keynote address that I delivered at the Development Studies Association conference in June 2019 in Milton Keynes at Open University. And Open University's International Development Department was celebrating its 50th anniversary. And the theme of that particular conference was opening up development. So it was all about deconstructing. It was all about, you know, turning development as a notion, as a process, as a political entity on its head. And I really wanted to focus on the idea of race because I find that it is, again, an absent presence in discourse, in policy, as well as in practice. And so what I argue is that development effectively suffers from what I call a white gaze problem. And the white gaze is a term that was developed by African-American intellectuals, scholars, as well as literary icons such as Toni Morrison, James Baldwin, Ralph Ellison, who really challenged one-dimensional racist tropes about Blacks in America. And I realized that this term, the white gaze, could really be used for thinking about how development is structured in hierarchies of dominance, right? So effectively, what is the white gaze of development? The white gaze of development is the assumption that Western whiteness and modernity are the primary signifiers of progress, of prestige, against which all others are deemed deviant, inferior, or incomplete, right? I also believe that development is structured along hierarchies of race and place, but there's a glaring silence on race and racism, not only in development scholarship, but also in development policy and practice. And the silence around race and development allows Western practitioners and scholars of development to avoid being accountable for the powers and the privileges that are derived from whiteness. This is an argument that Uma Kothari makes in a 2006 Progress and Development Studies article, which I think is brilliant. Everybody should read it. So the question that I ask then is, who controls the levers of development, of international development? It's really predominantly white people in the so-called global north, right? Not only scholarship, but also policy and practice. The other thing I try to do in the article is to show that while global domination or structural inequalities inbuilt in development are constituted by economic power, it's reinforced and justified by racial power, right, or racial hierarchies. And this is an argument that Kalpana Wilson makes in her really important seminal text, Race, Racism, and Development, another text that I think is important for everybody to read. I'm going to start referencing a lot of development scholars or people who are doing really cutting-edge, important work at the nexus between race and development, just as a referent point for people to look further into the scholarship. The other thing I think is important to remember is there are non-development scholars who also talk about race, one of whom is a Jamaican philosopher by the name of Charles W. Mills, and he theorizes something called the racial contract. Many of us know about the social contract, right? This universal law that says states and citizens have obligations, sort of a reciprocal obligation to one another. But Charles Mill takes this idea of the social contract and turns it on its head and says that there's a political, economic, and social system called the racial contract, in which white supremacy, global white supremacy is what he calls it, reigns supreme, right? It's a system in which white people benefit from political, economic, social systems that are structured in hierarchies of dominance. So this is one of the reasons why I believe the white gaze of development persists, is because of this racial contract. Another scholar by the name of Robin DiAngelo wrote a really important book called White Fragility, Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Race and Racism. And she argues that white fragility is the inability of white people to actually have conversations about how they benefit from global white supremacy, how they benefit from white privilege. And I think this is one of the reasons why the white gaze of development persists. Because going back to what I said earlier, who controls the levers of power of development? At the global level, at the national level, at the local levels, predominantly white people in the global north. Because white people have this inbuilt inability to really have deep and in-depth, meaningful conversations about how they benefit from white privilege, how they benefit from this racial contract, it becomes very inevitable that we don't have conversations about race when we're talking about development, even though it's clearly raced and placed. An important point related to the whole notion of white fragility and the racial contract is what I say in the article ultimately is that it's important for us to mainstream race as an anti-racist agenda for development, right? In the same way that Marxist and feminist scholars have mainstreamed not only class, but also gender, respectively. Yeah. And so what I say is that analyzing race forces us to see development in quotation marks as a global challenge, right? It's not solely a predicament of the so-called global South. So people of color across the globe, whether you have people of color in the global north or the global south, experience limited statehood, right? They experience material deprivation. They experience grinding poverty and inequality in the so-called global north at alarming rates. And we'll talk about this a little bit later, but COVID-19 is a primary example of how that, you know, the virus is disproportionately affecting people of color in the global north. And this is an argument that Amartya Sen makes in his book, Development as Freedom. We can't think about development as solely a global south predicament. These winding instances of inequality, structural inequalities, happen in the global north as much as they happen in the global south, and they particularly impact people of color. So what I argue is that scholars across the globe are increasingly taking up the charge to what a number of anthropologists call anthropologizing the West. So interrogating systems of racial domination, studying and critiquing how power and affluence in the so-called global North is derived, how it functions and how it operates. And I think, again, COVID-19 is a really great testing ground for thinking about these issues.
Thank you. And talking about how race manifests in the time of COVID-19, there's been recent statistics released by the NHS that have revealed that there has been a disproportionately large number of people from ethnic minority backgrounds dying on the front line because of COVID. And this is something that we need as a whole society to interrogate further now and in the aftermath of COVID-19. And also, focusing back on your research, you advocate for more awareness about the significance of South-South migration and processes that occur in the so-called Global South, rather than it just being a one-way relationship between the Global North and the Global South, or only relationships in the Global North. So could you perhaps link what you've just discussed to what you call the fallacy of the European migration crisis and the significance of South-South migration?
Sure. So a lot of people don't realize this because I think the media has done a thorough job of making us believe that so-called global South migrants are clamoring to get across the Mediterranean, clamoring to get to the so-called global North. But the fact of the matter is evidence shows, I'm going to keep repeating this, evidence shows that most migrants from the so-called global South actually travel within their regions of origin. They don't go to the so-called global North. They don't immigrate to the global North. Many of them don't even have aspirations to immigrate to the global North. So I'll give you a prime example from Africa, the region that I'm very politically engaged with, both at the scholarly level, but also at the policy level. The United Nations Economic Commission for Africa wrote a number of reports, and the most recent report documented that 80% of African migration is actually intra-African. So West Africans travel within West Africa. They might even go to Southern Africa or Eastern Africa or Northern Africa. So it's 80% of African migration is intra-African migration. Now, this maps onto migrations across the global South and other regions such as Asia and Latin America, so forth and so on, the Caribbean. So what I argue is that there really is no European migration crisis. What there exists is a crisis of European policymaking on migration. Two different things entirely. I'll give you an example from the case of the revolution in Libya from 2011. We all know that NATO basically led an intervention in Libya in 2011 that brutally ousted and assassinated Muammar Gaddafi by allying with rebel forces in the country. Now, before this happened, Libya was an economic haven for sub-Saharan African migrants. They weren't thinking about crossing the Mediterranean. They were thinking about settling in Libya because it had relatively liberal policies that enabled migrants from other parts of Africa to live and work without fear or favor. When Gaddafi started normalizing relations with the West, those policies became more restrictive and draconian because, again, he was in cahoots or negotiations with Europe and North America. And as a result, there was an unleashing of anti-Black, xenophobic, and discriminatory practices against sub-Saharan African migrants. Now, with Gaddafi gone, there's a complete vacuum in power. And as a result, Libya has basically imploded. Now the EU cannot use Libya as a buffer to stop the tide of African migration, even though most Africans were not even thinking about going to Europe at that time. They can't keep African migrants at bay any longer because, again, Libya is a so-called failed state. So now many African migrants who had settled in Libya for long periods of time are thinking about, well, what's the next stage? Crossing the Mediterranean, possibly. And many of whom had not even considered Europe or the Mediterranean as a viable or even a desirable location for migration. So this leads us back to NATO's intervention in 2011 and back to the faulty European policymaking of that NATO-led intervention. Now, I'm not condoning Gaddafi's behavior. I'm not condoning the fact that he was brutalizing his own citizens. But the fact of the matter is you've got the power vacuum because of that NATO-led intervention. And you've got the power vacuum because the policies that were liberal and very open to African migrants no longer exist in that particular country. So again, it's not a European migration crisis, it's a crisis of European policymaking on migration. Two different things entirely.
And this actually links very nicely to some of the issues you raise in your article for Al Jazeera English, titled Africa Does Not Need Saving During This Pandemic. And you touch upon this idea that European or NATO intervention in African countries is imbricated in the situation that we're seeing here today. And so could you explain why you chose to write the article and what it was all about?
The article came from two troubling and interrelated, I think, racist tropes about Africa in the age of coronavirus and before coronavirus. I just kept getting lots of newspaper links. I kept reading all these articles about what the so-called experts in the global north were saying about Africa as the final frontier for coronavirus, right? So the first thing that irked me and infuriated me was two French doctors who were on a national television program suggesting just very blatantly that Africa would be the most appropriate site for an unethical COVID-19 drug test because there are little to no regulations on the continent about what you can and cannot do in terms of medical tests. And now, given the long history of unethical drug testing on Black and brown bodies, I was particularly perturbed by this. So there are examples of Black Tuskegee Airmen in the 1950s in the United States being infected with or not infected with syphilis, but syphilis drug being withheld from them, from them being used because they were in a drug trial on syphilis amongst particular populations. There are also examples of Guatemalans in the late 1940s in Central America being infected with STDs just to test to see how well they might fare without a sort of placebo effect or without a cure. So again, this long history of unethical drug testing on Black and brown bodies. The other thing that troubled me was, again, this sort of doomsday apocalyptic framing by the so-called Global North experts of how COVID-19 was going to completely ravage Africa, right? And that the continent needed to be saved. By whom? We all know the carefully crafted tropes about only the West being the saviors of Africa. And for me, there's just sort of the sheer arrogance of this, of assuming this. Since Africa, number one, has recorded the lowest number of cases and deaths regionally, and how it was the global north, it was Europe and North America that was being ravaged by COVID. And so these global north experts sitting on their perches in countries that were really feeling the shocks of this particular virus, now pontificating about how they could help Africa, how Africa needed to be helped, for me was just really just troubling. And then played to, again, these sort of racist tropes about the continent being a space of death and destruction and mayhem. And so what I did was, instead of thinking about these particular so-called experts and their positioning, I said, let me turn the white gaze of coronavirus on its head by challenging these racist prescriptions and projections about Africa. And so what I began doing was documenting what people in Africa, what people in Asia, what people in the Caribbean and Latin America were doing to save themselves, not only themselves, but also others, and how the so-called global north had much to learn from these particular examples. So I'll give you some highlights. Senegal has developed a $1 diagnostic test for coronavirus. There was a young woman during the Ebola outbreak in Liberia of 2014-2016, a student nurse who basically took rubbish bags because she didn't have access to PPE. She took rubbish bags and created her own retrofitted PPEs out of these rubbish bags. Now, there are people in Europe and North America who are basically replicating this practice because there's so few PPEs available. India uses robots in hospital care wards to provide things like food to those who are not critically ill, so that the doctors then have free hands to now support those who are critically ill. Now, Rwanda was one of the first countries in the continent of Africa to close its borders very, very early on, whereas the United States and Europe decided to keep the borders open for longer periods of time. Cuba has sent medical doctors to Italy to help in their fight against COVID. Somalia has also donated 20 doctors to Italy. Singapore has done a fantastic job of massive testing and contact tracing. And Kenya's garment industries, like their factories, are producing 30,000 surgical masks daily to respond to domestic demand. Even Mauritius, the island nation of Mauritius, has a robust social welfare program that's been able to help people stem the tide of coronavirus. So everything from pension schemes to social protection, basic income in places that in the global north, these sort of social protection schemes don't even exist, right? So all these examples I'm documenting to show that, again, people in the global south are saving themselves. They have solutions that could be exported internationally. And now what I'm doing is I'm documenting these trends formally by using the hashtag Global South Solutions, because I think these solutions are not only best practices and good practice within the regions where they exist, but again, can be exported internationally.
And you really nicely pointed out there's a deep irony and an arrogance in the so-called developed world offering this kind of support and essentially offering to save the so-called Global South. And just with some statistics as well, Europe was named the epicenter of the pandemic in March and early April. The US has suffered the most deaths out of any country in the world, 86,000. And countries in Africa, Asia, Latin America and Caribbean are tackling the virus on their own terms for their own people, but also supporting the US and Europe. So could you talk a bit about how this challenges the assumptions made about humanitarian support exclusively flowing from the global north to the global south, and maybe elaborate a little bit about the role of race in these assumptions?
Sure. So there's definitely an underlying assumption, even if we don't want to admit it, it exists, that, again, the so-called global south. And it's funny, we're using these terms, but I think they're also very colonial. And as I stated in my keynote address that eventually became the Development and Change article, Decentering the White Gaze of Development, one of the things that I'm challenging myself to do is to come up with alternative terms that don't separate binaries that don't create these sort of artificial binaries between South and North, between West and non-West. But for the time being, we'll use these just because we haven't been able to come up with more emancipatory phrases. So the underlying assumption that the so-called Global South, and this is how I qualify by saying so-called because I think it's a problematic term. So the so-called Global South is a site of disorder, of chaos, of disease, of death, of destruction. But the examples that I provided in my Al Jazeera English article challenge these assumptions. So the examples I provide demonstrate that the so-called good or best practices can and should be exported from South to North, and that countries in Africa, Latin America, and Asia are far from perfect, and that they have their own pre-existing conditions, such as high levels of inequality and poverty, that make some susceptible to coronavirus more than others in terms of populations. However, the white gaze of coronavirus assumes that Black, Brown, and other non-white people are incapable of charting their own destinies or finding solutions to their own problems, much less creating solutions to global problems such as an international public health emergency like coronavirus. And these underlying assumptions, for me, are fundamentally colonial, and they're racist and they're faulty. So that's how race plays into how these particular tropes are reproduced over and over and over again in the media, but also in policymaking and scholarship.
Yeah, and pointing out that when you discuss how certain populations are, due to underlying problems, more vulnerable than others to coronavirus, which is a very unforgiving disease, there are many doctors now, particularly operating in conflict zones across the world, reporting that insufficient healthcare facilities like ventilators, a lack of electricity in rural areas to run them, and high rates of poverty will severely impact the mortality rates of people who do contract the virus. And so how do you think the international community and national governments should be responding in a way that avoids animating the white gaze in development, but does also ensure that people do get treatment and prevents unnecessary deaths?
Sure. Well, I'll talk about some structural issues related to why we have insufficient healthcare facilities, why we have electricity problems in rural areas, why we have high rates of poverty, why we have mortality rates in certain parts of the continent of Africa from coronavirus, but also viruses or diseases such as, you know, malaria or TB or HIV/AIDS. There's been, you know, neoliberalism is a very powerful process and entity. And I think one of the things that I've learned studying development in my own country, Liberia, is that, you know, this whole push to the bottom, race to the bottom, where there's been deregulation, where countries across the global South are increasingly told, states are increasingly told to have a hands-off policy when it comes to social protection mechanisms, that the market will prevail, right? So for instance, when my country recovered from armed conflict after about 14 years, one of the things that the World Bank and the IMF told us was that we needed to cut social spending. That was the first thing that they said in order to gain what they call highly indebted poor countries initiative, to reach a completion point for debt forgiveness or debt cancellation. Cut social service spending. And what was the first thing to get cut? Healthcare. Second thing, education. In such a way that Liberia was not spending enough on social spending. It wasn't providing enough electricity to parts of the rural areas. Wasn't thinking about paying health workers. Because again, it was about deregulating. It was about privatizing. All of these neoliberal market kind of phrases that we hear over and over again that are being foisted upon countries in the global South. Now, that's not to say that global South countries and leaders don't have agency. They clearly do. But when you have these sort of structural inequities that in which some countries are more powerful than other in terms of dictating what should and should not prevail, then it becomes quite difficult. So now we have a public health emergency and people are saying, well, why didn't they invest in healthcare? Why didn't they invest in rural electricity? Why didn't they invest in education? Why didn't they pay the health workers sufficiently so that they're not striking across the national schemes? It's precisely because of this. You know, the pre-existing conditions, the pre-existing structural conditions that led to some countries or some populations in these countries being more vulnerable than others has everything to do with the way the global economy works, has everything to do with how global policymaking works and how some countries are positioned much more vulnerably than others. So now I'll answer your question. I think the concerns are valid. I think the concerns about structural inequities, some populations being more vulnerable than others, not only in the continent of Africa, but in other parts of the so-called global South. But I think you know, these concerns are valid in Africa as much as they are valid in the so-called global north. So in fact, some scholars and public intellectuals have argued that blackness, that brownness or non-whiteness should be considered a pre-existing condition for coronavirus in the so-called global north, given how structural inequalities have made people of color in Europe as well as North America disproportionately susceptible to COVID-19. So the examples are glaring, right? So people of color are more likely to be migrant farm workers. People of color are more likely to be refuse collectors. People of color are more likely to be home care providers. People of color are more likely to be public transport workers, delivery drivers, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, other essential workers such as nurses and doctors are on the front lines of patient care, and many of them have lost their lives in the process. For example, anecdotal evidence points to the fact that more African healthcare workers have died on the front lines of medical care in the UK and the US than they have in Africa. So people of color are also essential workers in the medical field in the global north. So how about that for some perspective in terms of who is more vulnerable than others? In much of Africa, what I've seen is that COVID-19 really represents more of an economic catastrophe than a public health one. That's not to negate that COVID-19 is not a particularly pervasive predicament in the continent. The last I checked as of today, Mia, May 15, 2020, we have about 75,000 cases and maybe 2,500 deaths. Many people are saying that those numbers are underreported, right? We won't know until this thing has reached its peak and we are able to actually gather sufficient data. But that's besides the point. For me, I think one of the things that's important to realize is that because of Africa's place in the global economy, it suffers from an economic crisis in the midst of a public health crisis, in the same way that Latin America is in dire straits, or Asia, certain parts of Southeast Asia are in dire straits because of this very hierarchical, unequal, asymmetrical global economic system. Now, for international actors who take seriously that there is an economic crisis that is engulfing much of Africa because of its peripheral place in the global economy, I think they must take seriously the calls for debt relief, and in some cases, debt cancellation, right? So if you look at Africa's GDP to debt ratio, it's astronomical, it's staggering. Some countries spend up to 60% of their GDP on servicing debt. This is odious debt that has been accumulated, not by current leaders, but leaders in the past that just have not serviced those debts during long periods of just capital accumulation, when that money could be channeled to essential services such as health, such as education, such as, you know, electricity, such as infrastructure, agriculture, everything that you can think about when you think about how do you build a very robust economic system. So I think, again, if international actors in the so-called global north are really concerned about what's going on in the continent, right? And not just thinking about, well, how are we going to save the continent? Because I think the continent is already saving itself, but actually thinking about this thing structurally, then I would say a moratorium on debt or debt cancellation in general, because again, a lot of this debt is odious debt that has been accumulated over long periods of time, would be a structural way of responding so that countries across the continent of Africa, countries across Latin America, countries across, you know, Southeast Asia are able to use 60% of their GDPs for healthcare instead of debt servicing, which is crippling for so many places. Now, a lot of African leaders or public intellectuals are saying that maybe China needs to pay a debt to the continent because it wasn't allegedly particularly responsible in ensuring that people were aware of how severe this coronavirus was and sort of quote unquote unleashing it onto the world. Now, Africa has a large debt servicing to China, and many African leaders are in discussions with Chinese leaders and saying because China is reluctant to provide that kind of debt servicing. So I think these negotiations are spot on. I think they're really important because so much of that money could be used for other more important essential services.
Here we're talking about wider, longer term processes that will have to be really closely looked at now and also in the aftermath of the coronavirus, but also have been focused on for a very long time beforehand. And there have been lots of voices saying that things like structural adjustment programs are not doing what they were going to do and are actually very damaging. But on a more short term note about the way that national governments should be responding to the coronavirus. Some governments have been more successful than others, and we've seen that all across the world. And so could you give your views on what factors governments on the African continent should be considering and prioritizing when informing policy in order to best serve their people in avoiding the spread of COVID? And what do you think are the lessons to be learned from Europe and the US's failings? And how much should African governments be looking to the countries which have handled the outbreak more successfully?
Well, in my Al Jazeera English commentary, one of the things that I do is I talk about the fact that context must drive policymaking, so that one size fits all approaches won't work. What may work in Singapore may not necessarily work in Senegal. What may work in New Zealand may not necessarily work in Papua New Guinea. You know, what may work in Germany may not necessarily work in Gambia. So I think that's, for me, the key point that I was trying to drive in this particular commentary is that context must drive policymaking. And the sort of cut and paste, copy and paste approach that a lot of countries are adopting are actually unimaginative. They're not emancipatory. They're not thinking about what the context requires, right? So I think that's, for me, if anybody's listening to me, I would say that's number one, forefront. I think the US's and the UK's national government level bungling of the COVID-19 responses, for me, is just a stark reminder that, again, Western whiteness and modernity are certainly not a signifier of progress or expertise. I think Africans have already learned lessons from past outbreaks across the continent. So we've talked about different disease burdens that the continent faces. There are already processes of resilience that the continent of Africa has developed. So they don't necessarily need to look at Europe's and North America's failings for lessons, although there are many and they're glaring. And going back to this whole idea of that it's a glaring reminder that Western whiteness and modernity are certainly not the signifier of progress or expertise. For me, that's the major lesson, that inward-looking, internal, sort of domestic endogenous solutions are the key. But I think African heads of state, African leaders, African policymakers, African scholars, African thinkers have learned that contact tracing and massive testing are paramount. Now, this is across the board. They learned that isolating infected persons and providing them with critical care are important. They've learned that protecting the livelihoods of vulnerable populations is paramount as we approach a sort of peak across the board. They've also learned that investing in healthcare is absolutely essential, right? We can't stress this enough. I feel like after every single disease outbreak, the DRC just marginally got over Ebola. Ebola was a primary concern between 2014 and 2016 for Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, which were at the epicenter of the most deadly Ebola outbreak of world history. But we have selective amnesia. So in 2001, African heads of state gathered in Abuja, Nigeria, and they came up with something called the Abuja Declaration. They agreed to allocate 15% of their national budgets for healthcare because they recognized that Africa has a large disease burden. Very few of those countries across the continent, 54 countries, very few of them have actually fulfilled this pledge. So this is in 2001, Mia, 19 years ago. And how many disease outbreaks have we had in 19 years? How many people have died from malaria in 19 years? And we're still talking about a 15% allocation for healthcare? For me, again, the selective amnesia. I hope that after COVID-19, even though I think it represents more of an economic crisis than a public health one in the continent of Africa, we won't be talking about 15% in 20 years' time. That we will actually take this as an opportunity to realize that healthcare is the very basic level to demonstrate to a particular citizenry that you care about their well-being, right? Health is wealth, to sound very cliched. Very, very important. So I think after this, one of the things that scholars and activists across the continent and in the diaspora can hold their governments to account to say, wait a second, you signed this pledge, even though it's non-binding, you signed this pledge as a covenant to us, as a promise to us, as a contract to us, that you would make healthcare primary concern, a priority by allocating this 15%. So we've got a clarion call. We've got something very concrete that we can use to hold our duty bearers to account, to hold their feet to the fire. But I think while Africa can learn from its past and present healthcare predicaments, there are other examples, like Singapore has done a fantastic job of just testing massively and contact tracing. New Zealand, Jacinda Ardern's leadership has been phenomenal, just in terms of her compassionate care, being very decisive in her decision making. And then also the fact that people are responding to this, right, and listening to her, that says that there's a different kind of leadership that she is demonstrating that a Trump or a Johnson isn't, clearly. another example that I think outside of the continent is Germany. Now, a lot of people are starting to draw similarities or analyses to say, well, the women in the so-called global north who are exhibiting the best leadership, perhaps there's something about their gender that allows them to do this. And I'm not going to go into that direction because I think it's one that we'd have to, it's a bit more nuanced than that. But I think there is something to be said about women's leadership being a bit more compassionate in its care in terms of responding to these kinds of public health outbreaks. So for me, those three, so Singapore, New Zealand, and Germany stand out as shining examples of good public health leadership in a time of crisis. But again, one size fits all approaches will not work. What works in Germany, again, does not work in Gambia. What works in New Zealand doesn't necessarily work in Papua New Guinea. What works in Singapore doesn't necessarily work in Senegal. So I think, again, the sort of endogenous ways of trying to figure out what context, what solutions will derive from a particular context is really important. And that is something that we need to think about in the global south as much as we need to think about that in the global north. Now, there are some really good continental examples on the continent of Africa of countries that have done relatively well. Now, a lot of people are saying, well, we can't say success stories versus non-success stories because we're not out of the woods yet. But I think there are some countries that have done much better in terms of the initial response than others. So Ghana has done a phenomenal job. Senegal, again, with his diagnostic testing and its ability to test massively across the country, has done a phenomenal job. And little known, Sierra Leone, right, our neighbor in West Africa, has done a really, really great job of stemming the tide in terms of the numbers and being very concerted in its efforts to make sure that those people who have vulnerable livelihoods, such as quote-unquote informal workers, are provided. So thinking about, well, what are the social protection schemes that we can give to those who work in the informal sector? All of these countries have sort of thought about and thought through in terms of solutions. So they're continental examples, they're non-continental examples, but I think we all can learn from each other in this process, but constantly thinking about what context would require a particular response.
The themes that you picked up on, Victor, I guess maybe a wider process of a complete reevaluation of what really matters in life. So it's about health and education, which kind of form a fundamental basis for happiness before, in maybe in a simplistic way, but the economy. Some leaders have got that the right way around or the wrong way around, and we can see which ones have been more successful in dealing with an outbreak like this. And speaking to that, you also made a powerful comment at the end of your article, and I quote, "The coronavirus has exposed nature's wrath against the crudeness of capitalism." I was wondering if you could explain a little bit more about the link between capitalism, the coronavirus, and the environment.
Sure. So I was basically summarizing a long-form essay that Arundhati Roy, the Indian author and activist, wrote in, I think, the Financial Times. And she basically talks about the fact that coronavirus is a portal, and it's a portal for exposing these kinds of crude inequities, particularly of capitalism and how, you know, social protections are sort of scoffed at as a socialist kind of enterprise. But I think what's interesting is even in the midst of an international public health crisis, there are unequal global trade relations that are exposing themselves, right? And the fact that market competition still reigns supreme, still is the order of the day. So for instance, I don't know if you've heard about this, but there were a number of U.S. senators who were selling stocks before they crashed, because they realized that we were heading into a doomsday kind of scenario, right? So they had insider trading. They had insider information about these stocks that were going to crash. Again, the market is the rule, rules the roost. There have also been bidding wars over ventilators and other supplies, PPEs, which for me may foreshadow wars over vaccines if a vaccine is eventually developed for coronavirus. Again, the sort of unequal trade relations between particular nations where you can even bid over another country over a ventilator. For me, that's completely crude, right? And so whereas some countries have particular economic might, they will crowd out those countries that don't have economic clout in the same way that they do. And for me, this is a very dangerous system. And that's why capitalism for me is crude in that way. And coronavirus has really kind of exposed the crudeness of how capitalism works, how the market forces work, how competition works, and how might is right, you know, and having wealth is right, regardless of whether or not it's equitable or fair. So the fact that some countries have the wherewithal to bid over a ventilator, to bid over PPE supplies, says to me that the world is still very much structured in hierarchies of dominance. And, you know, that level of compassion, that level of international solidarity certainly doesn't exist because people are all ultimately only looking after themselves. whether it's making sure that their economic might is reinforced through these sort of bidding wars, or ensuring that their populations get the supplies before anybody else, regardless of how vulnerable they might be. So for me, it's just the whole system for me is just problematic the way it's structured. And it also forces us to really think about radical structural transformation. What does this look like when we get on the other side of coronavirus? I think on the environmental side, what I've seen is that, you know, the banning of international and domestic travel has really shown a discernible dip in CO2 emissions. The fact that we're not all gallivanting around on commercial flights, but then also those who have severe wealth, you know, you can't take your private jet to go anywhere. You can't take your private jet to go to the Canary Islands for holiday because we're all grounded. And those CO2 emissions have been, I can't remember the exact figures, but, you know, environmental scholars are actually saying that they've seen a discernible difference in the CO2 emissions in the past couple of months, just because people are not traveling at the rate that they have in the past. And something as simple as the lessening of air pollution. So in places like India or Egypt or in highly industrial cities in the United States, where you see a lessening of pollution. So I think it really also forces us to think about, well, how will we live as human beings when this thing is, I don't know, I can't say over, because a lot of scholars are saying this thing will live with us for the rest of our lives. But how do we live differently post-peak? How do we care for each other differently? How do we exist as human beings and thrive differently, knowing that the environment is at stake in as much as our economic livelihoods are at stake?
And with that, you've kind of second-guessed my last question. You also, and I quote, say that there is a better world beyond flattened curves at the end of your article. So perhaps this is cringy, but what does this better world look like to you?
I think there are a couple of things that I've been particularly concerned about. The first is thinking about how do we shift social welfare and social policy so that the greater good is taken care of, right? And looking particularly at those vulnerable populations. So whether they happen to be Black and brown people who have, you know, their race being a pre-existing condition for public health crises. So one of the things I've been thinking increasingly about is this whole idea of universal primary health care and how that should be a right and not a privilege. Now, the United States, which is one of the richest countries in the world, does not have universal primary health care. So I'm thinking about all those people who have either contracted the disease but can't go to a healthcare facility because they don't have healthcare. For me, that is a travesty. Now, I think Europe is much better because the social protection and social welfare programs are much stronger. But what will a universal primary healthcare, global universal primary healthcare look like, right? I think that's something that we all need to be thinking about, thinking through, and pushing our policymakers to institute post-peak. I think another thing that a lot of scholar activists have been talking about and advocating for is universal basic income, right? Across the board, where you have a living wage, everybody can depend on some sort of living wage, whether they work in the quote-unquote informal sector or the formal sector, whether they work as refuse workers or whether they work as, you know, contract laborers in a university system. Universal basic income is absolutely essential, because we see that the vast majority of people who have the wherewithal to stay at home are those who don't have to worry about precarious work, who don't have to worry about precarious incomes. And the fact that that has basically divided populations in different parts of the world, divided different parts of the world, but also divided populations within particular countries, should be a glaring example of why universal basic income should be a clearing call for all of us. How do you take care of the greater good? I think the other thing, and last but certainly not least, and most importantly, as the foundation for all of this, is radical structural transformation in terms of how the global economy functions and how it should function, so that there aren't these glaring inequalities between whether one country has access to a ventilator or a PPE and another country does not, just by virtue of how they are placed in that hierarchy of the global economy. So yeah, for me, universal primary health care, universal basic income, radical structural transformation in terms of how global economic systems work.
Thank you so much. And I think with that, we've come to the end of our discussion. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. Really interesting and inspiring discussion. So again, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Mia. It's been a pleasure.
That's all from us. Thank you for listening to Oxford Development Talks, presented to you by the Oxford Society for International Development and the Oxford Department for International Development. please head over to our website oxid.org or to qeh.ox.ac.uk if you are interested to find out more about the series. We have attached links to Rob Tell's articles, Africa Does Not Need Saving During the Pandemic, and Decentering the White Gaze of Development in the blurb. Big thank you to Alex and Lur for helping produce this podcast, and to Lorcan Cudlip Cook for the music. This has been Mia Simovic for Oxid. I hope you've enjoyed this episode, and please join us next time.